It's against that backdrop that we hear this lesson from the 13th chapter of Mark's Gospel. It's often referred to as part of Mark's little apocalypse, meaning it's a kind of literature that speaks of end times with fantastic signs and symbols. Jesus says, "But in those days and after that suffering, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven." From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake. This is for us the gospel of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Three Dog Night says one is the loneliest number that you will ever do. There's apparently some debate among songwriters as to whether I, S, or U is the loneliest letter. Life magazine, some 20 years ago, named the stretch of US Highway 50 that runs through the state of Nevada as the loneliest road in America. And somewhere out there is a whale swimming in the vast ocean all by himself, a whale that newspapers have dubbed the loneliest whale in the world. Well, Advent can relate. Advent is the loneliest season of the church year. It isn't the shortest season. That distinction belongs to Christmas, which is all of 12 days. It isn't the longest season either. That prize belongs to the Sunday after Pentecost, which sometimes runs to 28 Sundays. It isn't the holiest season because that mantle is claimed by Easter and its celebration of the resurrection. Advent isn't even the most illuminating season of the year because that goes to Epiphany with all its imagery of brilliant light. Well, I guess at least Advent can claim to be the first season of the church year, but that's not saying much, seeing as how everybody wants to rush through Advent in order to get to Christmas with all its goodies. We get to open our presents and finally sing Christmas carols, which have been cruelly denied us by the minister in the chapel. Poor Advent. It's like the old-fashioned carousel that everybody runs past on their way to get to the much more exciting Christmas roller coaster. Or, to risk violating my own principle, I think Advent is that scrawny, scrappy little Christmas tree that Charlie Brown picks out among all the much brighter, glitzier aluminum trees on the Christmas tree lot. For the 12 years that I have served here, I have made it my mission in ministry to let Advent be Advent. The quiet season. the season of expectation and preparation. But that task hasn't been easy because Advent isn't flashy or glamorous. It's the introverted season. By some people's account, Advent is about as exciting as a root canal. Advent, when you come to think of it, is the holiday we avoid talking to at the holiday cocktail party, afraid that when we ask Advent how it's doing, it's going to tell us in excruciating detail, and we'll wish that we had talked to Pentecost instead. That holiday sure is a little ball of fire. And Advent wants to be that fireball. Advent has the potential to be. It's just that Advent gets tongue-tied and manages to be long-winded at the same time, producing an effect akin to having Mel Tillis read the 7-day weather forecast. There's important stuff that we need to know, but after a while, it gets hard to stay focused on the message. I mean, things get off to a good start because Jesus is talking about the sun being darkened and the moon refusing to give its light, the stars falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens being shaken. And if you understand anything about the ancient Near Eastern world, you understand that when we talk about cosmic disorder, stars falling and suns being darkened, we're being told that something big is about to happen. Those are all signs of an impending change. And that something big, the impending change, is the coming of the Son of Man. It is the return of Jesus, what is commonly called the Second Coming. Only you and I aren't quite sure what it is we ought to do with Jesus' return. Officially, we are both looking forward to Jesus' return, and we're pretty darn excited about it. In reality, however, we greet the prospect of Jesus' return with the same enthusiasm as the teenager forced to sit next to her eccentric uncle at the Thanksgiving table. We know we're supposed to, but our hearts just aren't in it. Talk of Jesus' return makes us mainline Methodists nervous because in recent years, the return of Jesus, his second coming, has become virtually the exclusive province of what one scholar calls rapture-happy Christians, who tend to write awful books and make even worse movies, usually starring Kirk Cameron, about the end times. Our friends out on the fringes see signs of Jesus' imminent return in everything from falling oil prices to landing space probes on comets, so it can be all too easy to dismiss talk of Jesus' return as a subject deserving serious consideration, much less to motivate ourselves to be alert to the real possibility of Jesus' advent among us. And all of that is a shame, because we've reduced being excited about Jesus' return in power and glory. We've reduced that posture of anticipation and expectation to the level of the party line on the one hand. Yes, we believe Jesus will come again to judge the living and the dead. And on the other, to an object of ridicule. Left behind? Please! That's not even a compelling vision of the end times. In truth, as Mark Allen Powell argues, Jesus' return should be a defining reality that impacts our faith and our lives. Jesus' return should be a defining reality. It should shape who we are and how we are in this world. The question is, how do we make that future event a reality with daily implications? How do we take what most of us aren't even so sure about and say, this is that event that will shape who I am and how I act in the world? Well, I think the first step may be simply to acknowledge the difficulty of making Jesus' promised return seem real. I mean, there's talk of it. There are warnings about it. Some people are afraid of it, while other people look forward to it. But except for those most intimately involved in it, most people don't give Jesus' return a great deal of thought. So how does Jesus' return become real to you and me? Maybe in the same way a graduation or a wedding becomes real. Those who want to graduate, for instance, do so only by attending to the everyday realities of doing their assigned reading, studying for their tests, writing their papers. Those who want to get married, as Sarah and Taylor know, attend to the various tasks associated with getting ready for a wedding, coordinating with the caterer, ordering flowers, arranging for the photographer, meeting with the minister. Graduation day and wedding day will each happen in their own appointed times, but if you're going to participate in them in a meaningful way, you've got to do the work of actually being prepared. And woe to you if you are not. The second step in being prepared for a reality about which we are fundamentally uncertain is to admit, frankly, that we are of two minds about the prospect of the second coming. You see, on the one hand, a part of us looks at the world and sees all the suffering in it, all the heartache, all the people who have a hard time, and we know that Jesus' return will mean an end to all of that. Jesus' return will mean the eradication of disease, the elimination of poverty, the extinction of war, the end of death. If Jesus' return means ultimately that he comes to set everything right, then we are indeed ready and waiting for his return. But if we're honest, part of us looks at the world and thinks we've got it pretty good. We enjoy relatively high incomes and correspondingly high standard of living. We enjoy a high degree of personal freedom. Who's complaining? From our point of view, the world is pretty good. Jesus' return then to judge the living and the dead becomes somewhat more ominous as we suppose that we might not come out so well in that judgment. There's some measure of relief, then, in the fact that Jesus himself seems to have been of two minds about his own return. Because in the first part of his message, that bit about the sun being darkened and the moon refusing to give its light, the part with the falling stars and the budding fig trees, Jesus warns his followers to prepare for an imminent apocalypse. He's coming, and he's coming soon, so you'd better get ready and get ready stacked. But in the second part of his message, the bit with the homeowner who goes on an extended vacation and doesn't indicate when he's coming back, the point is that believers need to dig in, to stay faithful, to prepare for the long haul. It seems then as though Jesus cannot make up his mind. Is the end at hand? Is it imminent? Or is it delayed? Is it not at hand? Do we need to get ready now, or have we got a little while to get things together? Hence the value of the signs. Signs, after all, point to what's ahead. If you've ever driven on I-95 somewhere south of Virginia, you know to expect south of the border. I mean, it may be 200 miles ahead, but it's there because 175 roadside signs tell you it is coming. But you've got to know how to read a sign in order to make sense of it. A red octagon with the letters G-O on it doesn't make much sense. Neither does a sign that reads, "Entrance only, do not enter." Signs don't always interpret themselves, which is why you and I have to do it. When the fig tree's branch becomes tender and the branch begins to put forth its shoots, you know that summer's right around the corner, Jesus said. In the same way, friends, you've got to read the signs of the times to know when I will return. The only trouble is about that day or hour no one knows. Not the angels in heaven, not even the Son, but only the Father. So beware, Jesus said. Keep alert, for you do not know when that time will come. So when it comes right down to it, that may be the only sign that we need. The one that says, stay awake, keep alert, be on your toes, maintain your vigilance, be busy about the work that God has given you to do. Watch for the signs. Lillian Daniel calls this being awake to God in the world. Awake to that terrible moment when sun and moon will go dark, and the stars will fall to signal the advent of him who comes to judge the living and the dead. Be awake in that magical moment when the tender branch begins to put forth its shoots, and we know that summer's fruit will not be long in coming. Be awake for that right moment when the owner returns to his home to find that all is as it should be because we have been about our work. Awake for that gracious moment when Christ will come again to gather his own, to take them home, when all is right and all is well. Keep awake.